Good evening and welcome to our Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Cubberly Theater in Palo Alto. My name is Kirk Hansen, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Silicon Valley Advisory Board. It is my pleasure to introduce Ralph Nader, activist and author of Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. Recognized by Time and Life magazines as one of the most influential Americans of the 20th century, Ralph Nader has been a catalyst for health, environmental, and economic movements for more than 40 years. He is one of the country's most effective social critics and consumer advocates, and his efforts have helped set the framework for over 100 public interest groups for corporate and governmental accountability. Ralph made national headlines when his book, Unsafe at Any Speed, initiated automobile safety laws that included the National Traffic and Motor Vehicle Safety Act. He was also instrumental in creating the Environmental Protection Agency, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. In 1996 and 2000, Ralph was the Green Party candidate for President of the United States. And in 2004 and 2008, he ran for president as an independent. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ralph Nader.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Kirk, for the comments, and thank you all for being here. Heaven forbid that there be some students from Stanford University here. This is a work of fiction called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. Of all the books I've written, this is my first work of fiction. It's not a novel. It's in the tradition of practical utopian fiction. Some of you may have read, when you were a student, Edward Bellamy's famous book, Looking Backward, which came out in 1898 and envisioned a much more just and prosperous and happy America 100 years hence. And it sold a million copies in those years and helped raise the vision of the burgeoning progressive movement toward real possibilities, which is what practical utopian fiction often does, unless you're Ayn Rand. And I know that there's more attention in college curriculum, not to belabor the college years, on dystopias, 1984 by Orwell, Brave New World by Huxley, less attention to Upton Sinclair's books, for example, which projected certain future scenarios. Now, as the author of a lot of nonfiction books, why did I bother writing a fiction book? And that's worth an explanation. Namely, when I went to Washington in the early 60s to get the auto companies regulated, I didn't have much money, and I would hitchhike to Washington from Connecticut to make my contacts. At that time, there was really no state regulation of auto safety other than brake fluid standards written by the companies themselves, and certainly no federal standards. And it was the fourth leading cause of death in America and the first leading cause of death from age 5 to 24 years of age in our country. And I remember a truck driver picked me up in Delaware on the way to Washington, and he said, where are you going? I said, Washington, D.C. He said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm going to get General Motors federally regulated. I thought he was going to let me off in the side of the road. But you see, in those days, idealism was more realistic because what I did was I amassed the evidence, the overwhelming evidence, with contacts with engineers and scientists inside the auto companies and at places like Cornell Medical College and Harvard School of Public Health and elsewhere, who were doing experiments and research in human factors engineering and how people can be saved in crashes at pretty high speeds if they are restrained from going forward into the dash panel, windshield, or a rearward displacing steering column by seat belts, padded dash panels, stronger latches, collapsing steering columns, head restraints, side protection, and so forth. All which was long developed by auto engineers, but just shelved by the corporate executives in Detroit who, you know, were making a lot of money selling stylistic pornography over engineering integrity in the 50s and early 60s. And you amass the evidence, you go to key members of Congress who have the jurisdictions to regulate the auto companies, Senate Commerce Committee, House Commerce Committee, Senate Government Operations Committee. You have hearings. The press in those days actually reported hearings. They didn't just ignore them and write a feature once in a while so they could get the Pulitzer Prize. They actually kept on it. People like Drew Pearson, who was a widely syndicated columnist at that time, would cover it almost day by day. I'd go over to his home in Georgetown and put stuff under the door about what happened in certain committees, and the next day they would read about it. And so we had the press reporting it, had key people there in Congress, had Lyndon Johnson signing bills. No one signed more bills than Richard Nixon. He still heard the rumble of the people from the 60s, and he was the last Republican president to be afraid of liberals. So he signed the OSHA Act, the EPA law, Environmental Protection Agency law, Occupational Safety and Health Act, the Consumer Product Safety Act. There was almost nothing we could get through Congress that he wouldn't sign. And he didn't believe in it, but he had some great introductory statements and a signing ceremonies in the White House. And it was off to the races. I mean, there was a time when we would say we can get any bill we wanted through Congress for worker, consumer, environmental protection. The only thing was whether we'd have a veto-proof majority. And we didn't even need a veto-proof majority. And then the corporations counterattacked, starting with the creation of the Business Roundtable of high executives in the early 70s. Of course, the Democrats decided, with the help of Congressman Tony Coelho from this area of the country, in the late 70s to raise as much money from business interests as the Republicans. That was his persuasive case. And so they started getting money from all kinds of drug industry PACs and insurance PACs and banking PACs and oil company PACs and so forth. And increasingly the doors began to close on the progressive groups in Washington. And we had to work harder and harder to get less and less. And now you simply can't do what was done in the 60s and 70s. Not a chance. Look at the examples. They have the biggest collapse in Wall Street history. Crime, fraud, deception, greed, using other people's money, as Brandeis once said, and draining and looting trillions of dollars from worker pension funds and from mutual funds and other savings, destabilizing the entire economy, throwing it into a deep, deep recession, unemploying millions of workers, underemploying millions of workers, and they get bailed out in Washington with trillions of dollars of taxpayer obligations and subsidies, AIG, Citigroup, Bank of America, you know their names. And you would think that there'd be strong legislation. Well, it's been 13 months since Lehman Brothers went over the cliff, about 17, 18 months since Bear Stearns went over the cliff. Not a single reform bill has even cleared one committee. And what's coming out is extremely weak, compliments of Congressman Barney Frank, whose witty irreverence camouflages his toadyism for the banking industry. And, of course, Senator Dodd, he's having trouble in Connecticut in his reelection because he has been so concessionary to Wall Street interests and banking interests on the Senate side. So imagine, I don't know any period in American history where you didn't have relatively quick action. We got the auto companies regulated in 6 months from the first hearing to the signing in September 1966 in the White House. And so we are a society stuck in traffic. We have a gridlock in Washington. We have corporate occupied territory, which is my description of Washington, D.C. And it doesn't matter what party's in charge. There are always better people here and there in the parties. But overall, the two parties are corporate parties. And now we have the health insurance situation, which the majority position in America is single payer. How many people here are for single payer? The majority is single payer, full Medicare for all, free choice of doctor and hospital, much more efficient, much more humane, and will immediately save 45,000 lives alone, which are lost now every year because they cannot afford health insurance in order to get treatment. That's 800 lives a week. In 4 weeks, it's more than the death toll from 9/11. But, of course, they can't blame terrorists for this. But it's very preventable because nobody dies. Nobody dies in Canada, Belgium, England, Italy, Sweden, France, Germany, because they don't have health insurance. They're insured from the moment they're born. So this is a majoritarian-supported proposal, one. A majority of doctors favor it because they want to practice medicine, not bookkeeping, or have their hands tied by protocols of clerks from Aetna and Cigna and United Health. An even greater majority of nurses support it, led by the California Nurses Association, which is the most progressive union in America. Now, what's the story in Washington? Since Obama took office, off the table. He had people in the White House, United Healthcare. He meets CEOs from drug companies. But the leaders in the single-payer movement don't even get invited to the White House. It's off the table. In other words, not even discussed in Congress. It's off the table. You have to have some nurses and doctors modestly break up a Senate Finance Committee hearing a few months ago by just standing up appropriately, out of order, and say, you've got 13 witnesses, Senator Baucus, that are about to testify. Not one is single payer. Why? And they were carted off, handcuffed, arrested by the Capitol Police. This is a majoritarian position. This is the way every Western country and countries like Taiwan approach health care. This is government insurance, private delivery. Now, see what I mean by comparing it with the 60s and the 70s? Whether it's financial regulation, whether it's health care, with massive evidence of corporate crime, fraud, abuse, greed, where the health insurance companies actually compete with one another over how many people's benefits they can deny, how many people who are sick they can avoid. Can you imagine a more ghoulish, perverse incentive? And Washington is shut down. We have lost our government. We have a corporate government. And so I resort to fiction. But it's realistic fiction. Because when you ask yourself, what is the missing equation here? How come the people are for this change and this redirection in our country? How come the evidence is overwhelming? How come the other side doesn't even want to debate because they don't have a leg to stand on? And nothing happens. What is the missing equation here? There are organizers on the ground begging for full-time jobs right down to the neighborhood. There are great thinkers and advocates and analysts and researchers waiting for the opportunities to swing into action. There's people in Congress who want to do the right thing, but they're surrounded by corporate lobbyists swarming the corridors in the back rooms. So why doesn't anything happen? The answer is not enough money. Is that a dirty word to progressives? When you don't have one full-time advocate for single payer going up to Capitol Hill every year and you have over 2,000 represented the drug companies, the health insurance companies, and the hospital chains? Can you win a football game with one person on the field sporting a sprained ankle? The abolition movement against slavery was infused with money from proper Bostonians. The civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s got a leg up, got a lift from multi-million-dollar families like the Stern family in New Orleans and the Curry family in Virginia. And so the concept behind this book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, which, by the way, came from a grandmother that was thanking Warren Buffett, who had brought down convoys of supplies after Katrina, when he saw on television all these families fleeing, desperate with their children, no food, shelter, medicine, on the roadside. He went down and distributed supplies and had public health workers there. And she grabs his hands and looks in his eye and says, only the super rich can save us. And that haunts him all the way back to Omaha on the highway. And he convenes in January 2006 when this takes place. He convenes 16 other super rich, real people. He carefully selects them for things they've done in their past, for their advanced age, 70s, 80s, 90s. He has an uncanny sense of selection. He's worth $50 billion himself, so he gets his calls returned. And he gets them in a mountaintop hotel in Maui, which he completely rented, in January. And they lay out the strategy. This is not charity. Important as charity is, this is a social justice power collision to shift power from the few to the many with a top-down, bottom-up community organizing strategy by 17 real Americans in fictional roles who are hiring the smartest, toughest people in all the avenues that are required to take the will of the people, the decency of the people, the spirit of the people, even converse with people who are often written off by progressives. They go in with hundreds of lecturers on the ground, hundreds of organizers, and they go to the VFW, the American Legion, the Kiwanis, the Elks, the Lions Clubs, the Women's Clubs, the Junior Leagues, blanket the country. They decide that they're going to do this in 1 year to develop a sense of self-imposed urgency. They decide they're going to put billions of dollars of their money and the money of their peers, because when they put their money in, they kind of operate in rarefied affluent circles, and there's some interesting passages in the book, including Ted Turner, who's one of the 17. His longtime dream has been to organize billionaires. When he gave $1 billion in real life to the UN, you might remember, he organizes a group called Billionaires Against Bullshit in this book. And it is a serious group. And they exchange ideas on how they raise this money. And then they move out, like they have 400 recruiters full-time. They organize Americans in various categories as workers, consumers, taxpayers, voters. They start a clean elections party that takes on the veteran chairs of the House and Senate that never have any opponents. Goes right into rural districts. You'll see how the persuasion occurs. You will see a significant unity between conservatives, not corporatists, conservatives and liberals on these domestic issues, and it's all on domestic issues. They start a People's Chamber of Commerce because there are tens of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses who don't want to be represented by the Chamber of Commerce in Washington or by a National Association of Manufacturers. And indeed, they're defecting now on global warming from the Chamber of Commerce more and more. They develop a sub-economy where they buy businesses like dry cleaning establishments, insurance agencies, banks, auto dealerships, all over beauty salons, repair shops. They buy bill collection agencies. In order to find out the strategy of the trade associations, because they're inside them, and how they're going to counterattack, and in order to put best practice sustainable businesses inside the belly of the beast. They buy TV stations and radio stations, leverage buyouts. They want to get the media. You know, it's like a New Yorker writer, A.G. Liebling, once said, the way to get a free press is to buy one. They decide they have to take on and preempt the right-wing talk show hosts like Bush Bimbo and Pawn Vanity. And they have to distract them because they can see about May that they're starting to roar and bellow over the airwaves. So they put on national media two changes. One, to replace the Star-Spangled Banner with America the Beautiful as the national anthem. And the other is to get hundreds of inner city school teachers whose schools are crumbling to rearrange the Pledge of Allegiance from a untruth to a truth by having the children recite it and end it with the following words, with liberty and justice for some. Well, this outrages Bush Bimbo and Pawn Vanity. And they go into orbit day after day after day while the 17 are building. The 17 call themselves meliorists, by the way. And they know they can't do it themselves. They know, however, that they can be catalysts, they can lift up, they can provide shoehorns, and they can give an opportunity for full-time civic action and the political action involved in the Clean Elections campaign. Here are the 17. Warren Buffett, Bill Cosby, Barry Diller, Phil Donahue, William Gates Sr., Joe Jamail, major trial lawyer in Texas, insurance executive Peter Lewis, Yoko Ono, Max Pilevsky, Paul Newman, Ted Turner, George Soros, Leonard Riggio, Bernie Rappaport, Saul Price of the Price Clubs, Ross Perot, and Gino Pelucci. Now, some of you may know a lot of them. Some of you may know just some of them. They all bring something to the table that's very unique. Perspective, bravado, experience, connections, Rolodex, sectors. William Gates Sr. and Joe Jamail, for example, access to justice. That's their area. Gino Pelucci organizes the People's Chamber of Commerce, and he finds a super director whose name is Luke Skyhigh, a 32-year-old dynamo who drives the other trade associations up the wall with his creative forays, press releases, and exposés. Yoko Ono provides the spiritual, moral, and aesthetic dimension to a civic justice movement. One of the reasons why they succeed in bringing ever larger crowds in lunchtime in the center city, like Union Square, San Francisco, Fountain Square, Cincinnati, Chicago, Boston, Commons, is that they provide free lunch, music, and art, artistic, beautiful posters. She develops a beautiful logo called Seventh Generation I, that becomes better known than any corporate logo in America. Mind you, now they can get all the press, media they want, and because the media sees that they can get media because they can buy it, they give more media. They give more free media. And because their rich peers see what they're doing and it's so exciting, the whole country comes alive. They start coming in as part of the drive. They want to mask it to get people's attention on these one-minute ads. They pick Patriotic Polly, a scarlet, beautiful macaw, parrot that starts the ad by saying, "Get up, don't let America down." Sounds corny, isn't it? But it worked. They got 13 million emails on the first round. Now, the reason why this book is lengthy, although it has large print, is because it's all in the details to make it realistic. Once you accept the predicate of major money, smarts, good strategy, and community mobilization of the people of this country, who are looking for this kind of opportunity. They're looking for leadership. How many times have all of us joined social causes? And when we lose, we say to ourselves mentally, what if we had more money to have more organizers, more advocates, more publicists? What if we had more media to get across to people? What if we had people who could get their calls returned to influential people in Washington and elsewhere on our side? And so all of us who've been in social causes, unless we've won them all, have inside our brain a story like this. What if, what if, what if? If we don't ask the what ifs, if we don't imagine the possible, we won't reach. And if we don't reach, we will not grasp. And I didn't want this book to have any magic wands. I wanted to show step by step, and I put quite a bit of my own what if experience in it, step by step, how they did it, the nature of the massive counterattack and the power collision. The CEOs were so down on the trade associations that were unable to take on this tidal wave of mobilization that was coming at them. They formed their own powerful group of CEOs in New York, and they hired a Darth Vader type character, a 48-year-old attorney whose name is Lancelot Lobo, prefers to be known as Lobo. And you can see what happens when someone takes on the big boys, that's something not so small. That the retired, older, super rich take on the entrenched super CEO power boys. It makes for good drama. Warren Beatty, who's in this book running against Schwarzenegger for governor in 2006, and that's the whole story by itself, thought it would make a good movie. Leslie Stahl read it, 60 Minutes, Leslie Stahl, read it on her vacation in August and wrote me a nice letter saying she thought it was engrossing, creative, and funny. I said, I'll take all three because it's going to take that to get through. And it does move. When you read this book, I think three things you'll come out of it, at least. One, you'll come out a stronger citizen because you'll see what is possible once that equation of financial resources comes to bear. And two, I think it'll be an exciting read. And three, you'll never be as inhibited again asking very rich people to contribute to your causes. Saul Price takes on Walmart. He started the Price Club, merged into Costco. And Costco, as you know, pays better wages and benefits than Walmart. It still makes money. And when the Walmart bosses in Bentonville, Arkansas, learn that this agitation that's building up is led by Saul Price, they're horrified. Here's a man who founded the whole discount store movement. He knows everything about Walmart's vulnerabilities. Isn't it nice to have someone on your side, huh, who takes on these big guys from that kind of position? It's a top-down, bottom-up. They know right away they can't do it by themselves, but they know what the missing equation is. There are so many people in this country who want to get engaged in turning this country into right directions domestically and overseas. There's a great consensus on some of the fundamental redirections in our country, much more than the gridlock in Congress is now portraying. yet they don't have the means. If you don't have the means, it doesn't matter that you have the railroad track aiming in the right direction. It doesn't matter that you have the train on the track ready to go. If you don't have the fuel, it doesn't move. So I don't want to give away the endings and all, of course. But I do want to make one additional point. The reason why I picked these is they were in their 70s, 80s, 90s. As one of them said, when we want to move from success to significance. When they want to be known as having done something significant for their world and their country. When they want to be able to look at their great-grandchildren at age 9 and 10, when the searching questions come to them, where were you when all this happened? And want to be able to answer. And above all, their background was selected because in one way or another, they did make a bold, progressive move during their very, very lucrative career, or more than one. And I'll just give you one example. In real life, 5 weeks ago, Warren Buffett, who I had breakfast with actually over 2 weeks ago in Omaha, Warren Buffett went to the Senate and met with Democratic senators. His message? You must increase taxes on the very rich like me because we are undertaxed. And I'll give you an example, he said. I, Warren Buffett, paid 16% federal income tax last year. My secretary paid 25% last year. What was the response? A report said that some of them were bemused. The senators are rather bemused. Look at this. Second richest guy in the United States, he's telling us to raise taxes on the super rich. Ha, ha, ha. And the rest sort of backed away from him figuratively as if he had drug-resistant tuberculosis. These are Senate Democrats who don't even have the fortitude to roll back George W. Bush's tax cut for the wealthy, led by a multi-billionaire who is adored by a lot of people in the business community, if only because of his brilliant success. In fact, can you think of one significant deterioration of our political economy fostered by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney? Recidivist criminals in their criminal invasion of Iraq and their violation of federal statutes and torture, and they're incarcerating people in the thousands without charges and leaving them without lawyers and spying on Americans without judicial warrant, which they could get with snapping their finger from the FISA court. That's a 5-year jail term felony. Do you know one single step backward by the Republican regime that the Democrats who have controlled the Congress since January 2007 have rolled back or even tried to roll back? They haven't even tried to roll back the prohibition of Uncle Sam preventing the U.S. government from bargaining with the drug companies for volume discounts for drugs for the elderly that the taxpayer is helping to pay for. How long are we going to be represented by knaves, cowards, sinecurists, careerists, people who have no significance of their historical role as leading us in the federal government in Washington, D.C. People whose myopia does not transcend the latest political action committee party dumping cash from drug companies and oil companies and banks into their coffers. How long are we going to stay asleep if we don't imagine, if we don't reach, if we don't call the small number of elderly super rich who have progressive instincts, unlike the rest of their peers, and are willing to lay it on the line? $1 billion will get a single-payer health insurance. If you had 7, 8 multi-billionaires, and they're all over the place, And they put $1 billion in for an 18-month campaign to get this bill through Congress, when 30% of the members of Congress in a private vote are already for single-payer. Obama says he's for single-payers, can't exactly veto it if it comes to his desk and call it impractical. $1 billion alone can save 45,000 lives, reduce the anxiety, the fear, reduce the denial of needed health care, reduce the commercialization of the medical and nursing professions, the corporatization of medicine. What is $1 billion to these people? They would go down in history as legitimate historic heroes. Canada had a poll a few years ago. The question, who is the greatest Canadian of them all? And Tommy Douglas, the premier of Saskatchewan, won because he started the single-payer movement in Canada. Is that too far-fetched to imagine that we could raise that kind of money and organize every congressional district and basically say to these members of Congress, we sent you there to represent the people, not artificial entities called corporations. They can control their own destiny. They got plenty of money. But you're there to represent us. And you're there to make these corporations our servants, not our masters. That's the message we have to send them. The American people do far more difficult things than become engaged in civic and political activity. They raise children. They have to overcome ailing parents and grandparents and hold two jobs and hope that the daycare is decent for their kids day after day. They have to overcome accidents. They have to overcome not being able to meet the bills. They have to overcome deeper and deeper debt. But if we don't engage in political and civic action, if we don't find the people of means to give us that catalyst, that lift, that, those financial resources, we will be even more engaged in difficult private lives and having to overcome more and more obstacles just to have a decent livelihood. The drums of war toward Iraq started in 2002, as we remember, in Washington. And every month, the lies spread. Weapons of mass destruction, threat to the U.S., threat to the neighbors. Saddam Hussein, who had a dilapidated army that wasn't willing to fight for him, surrounded by much more powerful enemies, Iran, Turkey, Israel, could destroy Iraq in a weekend if he made a false move toward them or an aggressive move. He was surrounded by the U.S. military. We engaged in a criminal, unconstitutional war of aggression. In the 6 months leading up to it, 400 or so ex-generals, admirals, colonels, heads of security agencies, high officials, in spy agencies, retired, prominent ex-diplomats, people from the Democrat and Republican administrations, people like Jim Baker and Brent Scowcroft, the special assistants and representatives of George H.W. Bush, were writing editorials, op-eds, signaling to the incumbent son that his father thought it was sheer folly. And nobody organized them. They spoke once, that's it. Nobody gave them a secretariat. No one gave them a media budget. No one facilitated the kind of pressure to get congressional hearings and get Congress to adopt its own constitutional responsibilities with public hearings and cross-examination that would have exposed the lies and the false pretenses that plunged this country into war. That would have taken $50 to $100 million. George Soros was against the war. He spent about $3 billion on the open society in Eastern Europe, in the U.S., and elsewhere. He knows the score. He's written a book against the Iraq War. And he wasn't imagined enough to do it. Because nobody put a plan on his table. We don't aspire to those kinds of scenarios. And if we don't aspire, if we don't have the imagination, it's not going to happen. That war could have been avoided. That was a war of choice, as they call it. Over 1 million Iraqi dead, 4,500 U.S. soldiers gone, 100,000 injured, sick, and who knows what damage to our economy and our world status and what ricochets throughout that area of the world. 50 million? $100 million? Nobody organized them. They could have doubled and tripled their number. They could have gotten on TV. With that kind of money, you get attention on Capitol Hill. Let me close on this note. In the book, there's a mention of Jerome Kohlberg. I don't know if any of you ever heard of Kravis Kohlberg, you know, the merger and acquisition firm, big one. He made billions and got sick of it and quit a few years ago. And his passion was campaign finance reform. So he got some specialists together and probably spent $4 or $5 million, and nothing really happened. And so I guess he turned to other things. What if he had groups of people who came to him and said, Mr. Kohlberg, you're on the right track, but it's going to require $500 million to get it through Congress? That might have been different. The opportunities for your own favorite causes, migrant workers, prison reform, tax reform, they need resources. Never in our history have we had better and more books, articles, documentaries documenting corporate and political abuses, denouncing them, diagnosing them, proposing reforms. They're going nowhere. More muckraking books have come out in 20 years than in prior American history. They're going nowhere. Jeremy Scahill exposes Blackwater. Brilliant expose. Goes on Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, repeatedly taking it apart, unchallenged. Goes up on Capitol Hill. You know what the result was? That this corporation slaughtered Iraqis and made huge money, more than it should have, off these contracts, has just been given major contracts by the Obama administration's Department of Defense in Afghanistan. In other words, the sign of decay in a society is when powerful criminal economic forces become more influential in Washington, D.C. They become more bailed out, more vulnerable to non-enforcement of the laws. When you have Larry Summers and Geithner and all the people from Goldman Sachs and Wall Street who were part of this deregulation in 1999, who were part of the collapse, the speculative collapse, the looting and the draining, and they're in charge now of our government? At what point do we become socially indignant? It's not enough that we know what's wrong. The American people know what's wrong. They know who rules them. They know how they're being denied, excluded, disrespected, blocked, looted, defrauded, unemployed, underinsured. They know that. They know their jobs are going to fascist and communist regimes abroad, compliments of U.S. corporations and the subsidy from Washington. But until they feel something other than powerlessness, they will be reflecting apathy. Until they have fire in their belly to connect with what's in their mind, we're not going to get a social movement worthy of its significance for posterity. There's a phrase in the book where one of the 17 says, we're going to make apathy boring. And that's what we've got to do. The website is, for your comments and your suggestions, is onlythesuperrich.org. onlythesuperrich.org. I hope this book will find people who are connected with older super rich. And there's no better place than Silicon Valley, except they're too young. But there's no age ticket of admission here. It's just that a lot of the super rich are as amateurish as anyone else about how to get it done. And they go into good charity, but this is not charity. This is justice. A society that has more justice is a society that needs less charity. The book awaits people who can network ever richer people to give the American people a lift up, a catalyst, a shoehorn, an access so they can demonstrate what Senator Daniel Webster once said was the great work of humankind on earth, justice. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ralph Nader, for sharing your insights with us tonight. We have a number of questions from the audience, and so let me begin with one that came from several individuals. You haven't been known in the past for placing trust in the rich and powerful. Why do you think it'll work now?
Because I don't stereotype 100% of them. If just 1% or 2% represent the kind of people that are in this book, and these are not angels. That one reason they're so effective is they're not angels. We can make tremendous change, overdue change in this country. And so people often just take a label, the super rich, and they stereotype it 100%. It's wrong to stereotype any group. You defeat yourself when you do that.
You said it wasn't a matter of age when someone might make this transition.
Yes.
To have more of a sense of whether it's legacy or a sense of significance. What is it that transforms a merely rich or super rich person into the kind of person that you profile in this book?
I think they want to feel significant, and they want to feel they've made a historic contribution to the society that treated them so well. You know, William Gates Sr. was part of 1,000 rich people who stopped the abolition of the estate tax when the Republicans ran Congress a few years ago. It was 1,000 rich people. And he wrote a book with Chuck Collins where he said, nobody makes it alone. This idea, you know, this Ayn Rand idea that you make it alone. And he went through that. He got the GI Bill of Rights. He had public education. You have public infrastructure. You have all kinds of things. And Warren Buffett said, make it alone. He said, what if I was born in Bangladesh? He said, I was lucky. He said, I was born in the United States right from the beginning. He said, right from the womb. He said, I was lucky. So I think that they don't want to leave a country, their beloved country, in a state of relentless decline. And there are people who find that an important motivating sentiment.
There are several questions about whether you discussed the book with those 17 individuals or did you surprise them when it was published?
Surprise. Yes. You can't, when you're writing fiction, you can't call people up and say, I'm going to give you fictional roles. I mean, it's been done to me, by the way. I've been in fictional roles. I gave them the courtesy of a very early call. The minute the book was published, I sent it to them. So they had it before anybody would call them. But they are hard to reach. I mean, they're still very busy. Some of them are ill. But no, I didn't talk to them ahead of time.
And a couple of people said, so what was their reaction when you called them or when they heard that they were in your book?
Well, one of them said, I'm blown away, as his words. Another one was a bit nasty. I have to work on that person. Warren Buffett was intrigued by it. He hadn't read it when I had breakfast with him, but he made some comments indicating he knew some of the characters in there. Phil Donahue's in the middle of reading it. Ted Turner's reading it. So we'll see. It's just come out, and it's fairly large. I can see where they don't want to speak to the press unless they read everything, because there's some quite a bit of dialogue here.
There's a comment that you made your huge impacts during the 60s and 70s with very little money.
Exactly.
And yet, in the book and this evening, you said, we don't have enough money to be activists today. Why the change?
One, there's the old Democrats and not the new Democrats. If we had the old Democrats, and they weren't, you know, angels either, we would have single payer by now. We'd have living wage. I mean, they froze the minimum wage. You have 47 million people in this country who are making Walmart wages. need more be said? If the minimum wage was adjusted for inflation, starting in 1968, it would be $10 an hour today. It's $7 and a quarter, having been raised just 3 months ago. Yeah, but I'm just saying, just to show you, the productivity of the worker since the 60s almost doubled. And the minimum wage in real dollars is $2.75 less than it was in 1968. Talk about going backwards into the future. And at the same time, Walmart's bosses are making $10,000 an hour. $10,000 an hour. But, you know, before noon on January 2, they've made more than most of their workers individually make in an entire year. Before noon on January 2. So I realize when the power shifts occur and they're concentrated, and you can't do today. And I've talked to a lot of younger people who've tried to do what I did. You cannot do it today. The doors are closed bipartisan style in Washington, D.C. It's what Franklin Delano Roosevelt warned the Congress about in 1938 when he sent him a message asking for a commission to investigate concentrated corporate power. And in his pithy way, he said, when government is controlled by private economic forces, that's fascism. That's the word he used. 1938.
There are several questions about how you expect and believe this money that now would come in the hands of activists or aging activists would be deployed. Why do you think that $1 billion could bring a single-payer system or $150 million could have stopped the war?
The evidence is overwhelming for it. All other Western countries have it. The huge number of lives saved, sicknesses not prolonged. The public is supporting it, and there's almost no activity to congressional district except a few nurses, a few doctors, and groups like Single Payer Action or the Alliance. So that's a terrific predicate for winning this. It's 60-some years after Truman proposed it, for heaven's sake. And so the money would be used to organize powerful mobilizations of people in each congressional district. You see, we can't exaggerate the power arrayed against the people, because if you do, you'll feel very discouraged. There are 535 men and women who put their shoes on every morning like you and I who are in the Congress. Corporations, 1,500 of them, get their way with the majority of them. Corporations have money. They don't have a single vote. We're the ones who have the vote. And that's what this $1 billion would go to. Plus about $100 million of mass media, day after day exposés of the horrific consequences in death, injury, and economic anxiety that the health insurance companies and the drug companies are producing in this country.
One person, we're talking with Ralph Nader about his book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. There are questions about the impact on the public of these campaigns that the money pays for. The question is, why do you assume that the public is ready to adopt the policies that this group of 17 leaders advocate?
Well, if you look at page 76, those are the seven pillars that they adopt, seven redirections that they're advocating in America. You'll see that It's a majoritarian sentiment. I think a living wage is a majoritarian sentiment. I think a single payer is. I think cracking down on corporate crime with adequate resources, definitely. I think that decriminalizing marijuana and emptying the jails of small possessors of marijuana and filling them with convicted corporate criminals is a tremendous one. I think the tax reforms that Warren Buffett wants, huge majorities here. The divide and rule technique is a tried and tested rule of the power structure in any society. But when you've got resources at the base and people start meeting and convening and talking to one another, it's a remarkable consensus. I'm not saying it's 100%. There will always be certain divisive issues like choice and right to life and NRA, et cetera. But on basic economic issues and political reform, big, big consensus. Do not ever mistake a corporatist for a conservative. They love you to do that.
This question says, is there a downside to activating the super rich that those super rich who don't believe as the 17 do may defeat the whole enterprise?
That's a good question. The question is, well, how about all the other reactionary super rich? They counterattack. My answer is they already own the government, number one. And number two, Ted Turner develops these great solar festivals, very flamboyant, funny solar festivals around the country. And there's a dialogue of the the corporate counterattack. And they're saying, we've got to do something because they're going to replace fossil fuels. They're going to replace nuclear. Solar is coming. And one of them says, oh, yeah, let's put on our coal-burning festivals. So
there are several questions about women in the 17.
Yeah.
Why only Yoko Ono? Why didn't Oprah make it?
Too young. There aren't many well-known, very rich women in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. And Yoko Ono, by the way, wasn't just the wealth. She has a lot to contribute. Some people make fun of her because she puts ads in the New York Times with the word peace. What do they want? The word war? I mean, do they like Lockheed Martin and all those ads? More and more weapons, enough is never enough. So that's one reason. The second reason is this is a generation of older people before the latest women's rights movement. They succeeded. Now there are women, African Americans, Hispanic Americans, who are beginning to be a few of them begin to be very rich, but they're mostly in their 40s, 50s. Early 60s. The key here was the older generation taking hold. It's very dramatic for the young. It's very dramatic. I mean, what is this generation that deals with computers, what are they going to say to their grandchildren when at the age of 9 and 10 they're sitting on their lap and say, grandmother, grandfather, where were you when the world was collapsing? What did you do? What are they going to tell them? They were too busy updating their profile on Facebook?
There are a number of questions about health care. And the question is really, how do you analyze the current health care impasse, the role of the insurance companies and the other players? How do you think this will come out?
Very badly. It's not going to solve the volcanic increase in bills and price and denial of benefits. It will curb a few outrages in the insurance policy, like pregnancy is a pre-existing condition, excluding from health insurance. But they have ways to get around that and force people out. That's what their perverse incentive is. They can't help themselves. They make more money by rejecting their policyholders' claims. And so what will come out with X million of people will be covered in a fashion, 28, 29 won't be covered. More people begin to drop out because the prices are continuing. There are 30% increases already being registered around the country. Huge deductibles, co-payments, exclusions. This is an industry that has to be replaced. When Medicare came, it replaced the health insurance industry, except for the Medicare gap. Now they're destroying Medicare with Medicare Advantage. They want to destroy Medicare for the elderly as they know it. So there's not going to be any controls over drug prices, even though a lot of the drugs they sell us were developed by taxpayer money through the National Institutes of Health, like Taxol, AZT, a lot of the anti-cancer drugs that the drug companies get under monopoly marketing agreements from the National Institutes of Health and try to persuade us that they're the ones who put the research and development. And that's true, not true. So it's not going to work. There's going to be a second round of single payer. The National National Physicians for Health Plan, NPHP and women, NPHP.org and singlepayeraction.org, and you'll be on the frontiers of what's building in this country.
Two quick final questions. Wait. One is, are you still campaigning for corporate accountability, and what do you think of the kinds of campaigns of people like Muhammad Yunus for social business?
That's good, social entrepreneurship. It's a little soft in its concept, but its thesis is you go into markets that the big corporations don't want to deal with, essentially redlined markets, small microcredit markets, and or you provide services for people such as community health clinics, community energy entities at the local level, real community credit unions, which displace the banks to the extent that they displace them by meeting them at the community economics level. But I think right now global corporations have reached a pinnacle of power unchallenged in the world. They love to deal with dictatorships who give them franchises, concessions, and anything goes here as long as you grease the palms. And so I don't think they are reformable according to New Deal ways. I think we have to do two things: a movement to subordinate them to the sovereignty of the people by stripping them of corporate personhood. They should not have the they're artificial entities. Only human beings should have constitutional rights. And that would include employees of corporations. But as an entity, the corporation should not be allowed to lobby, engage in political activity, give money to politicians. So one approach is subordination to the sovereignty of the people, and the second is displacement by community economics with modern technology. And yeah. I might add that we had a whole conference on this in June 2007. Its proceedings are on the web. It's called tamethecorporation.org. So you'll see the entire proceedings of subordination and displacement. Those should be political agendas of the first order of magnitude.
Ralph Nader, you can guess what the final question is. Besides the one that says, will you run for California governor? What are your electoral plans? Do you plan to run for president again? And of what importance is electoral politics in the years ahead?
Well, it's very important. You have two tracks, the civic movement and the political movement, and each one can't really work without the other. So I've run now three times. I've had people say, you've got wonderful agendas, you've got majoritarian positions, but you can't win, therefore we're going to go for the least worst, and not make any demands on the least worst because we're petrified of the worst. So the least worst becomes worse every 4 years, the Democrats and the Republicans. I think the progressive agenda has got to be on the ballot every 4 years to give the voters choice, to keep the progressive flame alive. And I'd like someone else to do it. As far as my plans, it's too early to say. I'd like someone else to do it. So that's the answer to the question.
I hope you all have enjoyed. I hope you all have enjoyed tonight's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Ralph Nader, activist and author of Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. We'd like to thank our audience here in Palo Alto and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.